devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Tuesday evening, joined tonight by Kyle.
Hi, Emmanuel. This is Kyle.
Yeah, I just said that. And we're here for another action-packed full hour of our program. This important news, we will not be on next week. We have an adventure planned. We have an adventure planned, and there's also a game plan, so it kind of works out. That's going to be fun. We'll be back in 2 weeks, if the adventure goes well. And Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to all kinds of things. It's another one of those days where all kinds of things happen. I'm looking at this news report right now. This is the best headline I've seen in a long time. Chinese woman carrying thumb drive with malware arrested at Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort. I mean, wow. Okay, this one writes itself. I hats off to her. I don't know what she was going to do with malware on a thumb drive. First of all, okay, there's a lot here. The fact that she's Chinese, I don't know how that enters into it. I don't know why that's relevant, but that's the Washington Post headline says that. Okay, she had a thumb drive on her. At what point does somebody at Mar-a-Lago walking in there, at what point do they get searched and have the thumb drive read and then analyzed to see if there's malware, in fact? I mean, can you do that for me? Because I've got several thumb drives on me right now. I'd like to know if there's malware on them. It seems like a good service they're providing.
Yeah, I've got one, too.
You want to go to Mar-a-Lago right now?
I mean, no. But
if there was high-speed rail, we could get there, but there isn't.
You raise an important distinction, though. I mean, there are definitely non-Chinese folks that are state actors for the Chinese government, but I think that's the implication, right? That, oh, she's Chinese, so this must be some sort of high-level coordinated attack, and we're to sympathize that foreign adversaries are attacking Mar-a-Lago.
Well, if we're not going to do it, someone has to, you know? And it's just, there's a lot here. I just saw the headline, just came out, and it happened over the weekend, apparently. There was a search of her belongings, turned up 4 cell phones, a laptop, a hard drive, a thumb drive, which contained malicious malware. And apparently, what's the big deal? It's a country club. So she walked into a country club she didn't belong in. You know, I do that on average about twice a month. There's no indication that she was going to use the malware against a particular machine. And if she did, it shouldn't have anything to do with our nation's defenses because it's a damn country club. You know, this story, I'm sure, will develop more.
The multiple cell phones is pretty suspicious. In some of the other reports of people having been compromised or passing, doing industrial espionage and passing intellectual property secrets from government institutions or large industries, it's often that they're issued cell phones, and this has been presented as evidence in some of those cases. Basically, highly customized cell phones that they're equipped with from state agents.
Mm-hmm. Well, but the thing is, it's a country club. You know, that's the thing I have to keep coming back to. It's a damn country club. It's not a national strategic area. I know he's treating it that way. I know that he conducts all kinds of business there that he shouldn't be conducting. But we shouldn't change our definition of the place based on his actions.
Well, yeah, and if we're going to, I guess, go that route, then you could also point out that individual one doesn't use computers, so what's the point anyway?
You already said today, I know you were watching C-SPAN, and I heard his voice. Uh-huh. I have to tune him out. But he was talking about, for some reason, he was talking about Germany. He was talking about how his dad's German. He was born in Germany. His dad was born in New York City. He doesn't even know where his own father was born. He said this today. He said his dad was born somewhere in Germany. And if you look it up, he was born right here in the United States. What's going on here? Is he really having memory lapses, or does he just not know, or is he just so used to lying that he can't turn it off?
I think it's like a bit of like senescence. Like he's going in and out of lucidity, but also just his own like reaction to maybe like chemicals from spray tan or something. Like just basically, or all the hairspray that he's inhaled over the years. Something's going on, but basically, like, there's less blood flow to his brain, or just a total lack thereof, the brain, that is.
Total lack of brain, yeah. Okay, well, it's of concern, and I think, you know, this is not something to just let go by. If you're, especially considering the hell he put Obama through with where he was born, if he can't even get his own dad's birthplace correct, what are we talking about here? Who are we talking to? It gets more insane by the week. But you hear that this guy today, he has a cast of characters that you simply cannot believe, and there's new ones crawling out from under rocks every day. This latest one, White House Deputy Press Secretary Hogan Gidley. You hear about this guy, Hogan Gidley?
No.
Just like saying that name. Hogan Gidley.
Okay, stop. Please stop.
No, Hogan Gidley. I'm having great pleasure saying Hogan Gidley.
I will walk out of this radio station.
A lot of people will, but I'm still going to say Hogan Gidley. I mean, it's like your super villain name that somebody comes up with in a script and it gets sent back saying make it more realistic. Okay, so you may ask what Hogan Gidley did today, and I'll tell you what Hogan Gidley did. I'm sounding like Flanders. Hogan Gidley Diddley. Okay, during an interview on MSNBC, I remember when that name sounded funny. Gidley railed against the Puerto Rican government's handling of federal hurricane aid. That's the latest thing. We're anti-Puerto Rico because why exactly? Because they're Puerto Rico? Because they expect to be treated as citizens because they are? Well, he basically claimed officials left food to rot at the island's ports because that's what Puerto Ricans do, is leave food to rot.
They couldn't access. They had no roads. Like... Okay, go on.
His comments came after Trump falsely claimed, and I'm just going to do an aside here for a second. Trump falsely claimed that Puerto Rico got $91 billion for the hurricane. No, they didn't. That's how much damage there was. It was the third most damaging hurricane in our history, Atlantic Coast hurricane. I don't know if the Pacific Coast ones are more damaging than that, but third, you know. And that's a lot. That's more than any of the other ones in the last couple of years, the ones that affected Texas, the ones that affected Florida. So, okay, Puerto Rico got $91 billion for the hurricane. No, that's not true. They've not but Gidley is basically spreading this around. He said they have not come to $91 billion, I don't know what exactly that means, with all we've done in that country. In that country. This guy doesn't know that Puerto Rico is part of the United States. He calls it a country. He later said that that was a mistake. It was a slip of the tongue. And when he was asked if that mistake contributes to how the White House views Puerto Rico, he said, once again, it was just a slip. A slip of the tongue is not on purpose. It's a territory, not his tongue, the Puerto Rico. Sorry, Gidley, it's more than a slip of the tongue. It's how you perceive the place. And, you know, if you call somebody something that is demonstrably false, if you use a bad word to describe somebody, you can't call it a slip of the tongue. And referring to a territory, a part of the United States, as a country, as a foreign country, it's not a slip of the tongue. That is how you viewed it at the time. Whether it's in the back of your mind, whether it's in the front of your mind, doesn't matter. That is how you perceived it. That is how your comments are being steered by that particular train of thought. And obviously Trump feels the same way too, because if you compare how much Texas, how much Florida got for the hurricane damage, they got so much more, and the hurricanes damaged so much less. Puerto Rico received less aid from the federal government after Hurricane Maria than Florida and Texas did after Hurricanes Irma and Harvey. That's according to a study published in January. The disparities in treatment towards Puerto Rico were obvious in the days after Maria slammed into the island on September 20th, 2017. Can you believe it was that long ago? Almost 2 years. That's how long it's been. They have not recovered. While the U.S. territory was reeling from the destruction caused by 155-mile-per-hour winds and a total electrical blackout, Trump issued a state of emergency for Puerto Rico, then went to play golf in New Jersey and complained about NFL players protesting police brutality. And when he finally did visit the island 13 days after landfall, he threw paper towels at hurricane victims and lauded the fact that only 16 people were officially listed in the death toll, despite multiple reports indicating dozens of fatalities that had been included. The final death toll, 3,040, at least so far. Within the first 9 days after the hurricanes hit, both Harvey and Irma survivors received nearly $100 million in FEMA aid. Maria survivors, only around $6 million. Think about that, $100 million to $6 million. And Maria was a much more fierce hurricane, a lot more damage.
Is that more people that died than 9/11?
You know what? It's around that figure.
Pretty much exactly the same, right?
It's around that, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, go figure. And what do they get? They get a 5%, right? So
around 6%, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
2 months after landfall, Harvey survivors had received $1.28 billion in federal aid. Irma survivors received $899 million in federal aid. So people know, this is what you can expect. The hurricane hits you. Harvey, Irma, they were bad hurricanes, but they weren't devastating like Maria. But this is what you can expect as an American citizen. Harvey survivors, $1.28 billion. Irma survivors, $899 million. So Maria, you know, you'd expect this, since it was a worse hurricane, maybe, you know, $2 billion, at least $1.5, something in that range. What did they get? They did not get $1 billion in funds until 4 months after the storm. And as I said, 2 months after the storm in Texas and in Florida, Harvey and Irma survivors received that amount of money. So double the amount of time to get that kind of aid. I mean, it's unbelievable how they have been treated. And there are so many more numbers that we can point to, but it's obvious. And you can tell by the way they're being talked about, by the way they are being insulted, and the fact that they still are dealing with the effects of this. It's shameful. It is absolutely shameful. So, you know, when this guy comes out and refers to it as a foreign country, it's no mystery how he got there. Hogan Gidley, that's a name he'll be remembering for quite some time.
What is his role again?
Deputy?
Why do we care about him?
I want to get this right.
What authority does he not have?
Deputy Press Secretary of the White House.
So he's Sarah Huckabee's, like, underling, right?
I guess. I don't really know the whole structure there, but he has full access. So.
She's a sheriff, and he's a deputy.
But, you know, you don't really see her that much. They have one press conference this year, one White House press conference. It's ridiculous. It's insane. It's anti-democratic. And we have to never forget that. And I know, you know, it's annoying to always be pointing these things out, but they're true. It's what's happening, and we deserve better.
So great.
Yeah. So that's what's been going on over there. There's other things too. when you only have an hour, you have to weed out a lot of things. So the Mexican border might be closed. Now that, you know, I was looking that up. I thought this happened before, and in fact, it was closed back, I think, in November for a few hours. There was one crossing, but what Trump wants to do now is close the entire border, and that's going to be devastating. For our economy as well as other economies, he's upset that Mexico is allowing people to enter their country from other countries. So now the problem is no longer the Mexicans. The problem now are the Hondurans and the El Salvadorans and everybody else down there that's being led into Mexico, and then they want to come to this country, and Mexico's not doing enough to act like us and build a wall to keep them out. So now he wants to keep everybody out coming from Mexico, including U.S. citizens.
Think about what that's going to do to inflate the illegal crossing numbers at non-border crossings. In other words, places where there are not official border crossings, those people will have zero alternative, right, to seek asylum or whatever at the official ports of entry. Mm-hmm. So whatever individuals and families or whomever is there is trying to get across will then maybe surge at those other parts of the border. And that just, I think, in their crass calculation would lend credence to inflated or high, I think inflated, but higher numbers, so they can substantiate more draconian regulations and at least pump up whatever kind of campaign speeches he's going to be having.
He's succeeded in making this a crisis in the eyes of many. We heard this on CNN the other day, that was it 2,000 migrants seeking asylum had to be released because they ran out of space. And it made it sound like we've released all these criminals. And, you know, they're people seeking asylum. This is what we used to do. People would seek asylum. They get a hearing date, and they would be in the country. Just like we can go to another country if we want and be allowed to be in that country until such time as either a hearing comes up for us to seek asylum or our time there runs out and we have to go back home or someplace else. But to make it sound like these 2,000 people who were being held as prisoners had to be released. First of all, it ignores the fact that they should not be held like prisoners.
That's us.
Yeah. And the fact that they are released, that's a good thing. That's not a bad thing. These are not drug dealers. These are not murderers. These are innocent civilians seeking a better life, much like our ancestors did. Pretty much everybody, except for Native Americans, in this country. We didn't bat an eye at that. So to make it when you hear CNN doing that, you know, we expect Fox to do that. But when all kinds of other media just accept that as a threat, you know, in the way they present it, I have to say Trump is winning. He's changing the narrative. He's making it seem like this is a problem when it really wasn't a problem. It was a problem for the people who were trying to get a better life, who were trying to flee horrors that we can't even imagine. But for us, you know, we only benefited from this. We had multiculturalism. We had all kinds of people doing jobs that we didn't want to do. We had a stronger nation. We had more patriotic people here that wanted to be here.
Not just jobs we didn't want to do, but people creating businesses, people creating families, contributing to the economy, spending dollars mm-hmm. in our country, buying all that fast food or whatever. You know, clothing and commodities and stuff, keeping other businesses and supporting other industries, propping up towns and entire communities that otherwise would not have as much going on or be able to hold businesses there because of the labor that is available and, mm-hmm. and innovating and on and on and on and making us a little bit. Yes, more diverse and eclectic.
Yeah, and it's you know, widely seen as somehow a threat. Somehow, it's like his opening statement where he calls them rapists and murderers and drug dealers and things like that. And we're almost at the point of accepting that. I mean, sure, any group of people, you will find bad people, absolutely. But to label the majority as that is it's something that we should never accept, and I feel like we somehow have, and so we see this immigration as a problem. There's a problem, absolutely. The problem is the way we are treating them. The problem is the way that we are trying to treat people as if they are criminals when they haven't done anything wrong and they are following the law that we set. Set out as far as how to enter this country and seek asylum. And also, you know, we share responsibility in conditions in other countries as well because of things that we help to set up in those nations that cause living hell for people, that make them want to leave, that make them want to run away. It's a big deal to leave your homeland and to want to go someplace else. It's devastating.
So just to reiterate, though, the original point you brought up, which is this reporting. I mean, that was, I think, CNN and what was it? I think Brooke Baldwin, some of the other commentators and newscasters in the media are just, they're picking up these salient bits of vocabulary that contribute to the framing of these people as criminals. It really plays into the characterization that the right wing and this administration is trying to push. So I would caution, I think, everyone that's trying to cover this issue to be very, very careful about the kinds of language that you play, that you basically put out there, that you're circulating. You may not realize it, but it's damaging to use the same language. I mean, I don't know how you talk about releasing people without saying they were released, but you need to point out that these policies and the kinds of punitive attitude of treating people like prisoners, that that entire language is creeping its way into people that, as we are talking about here, like, they're just regular people that have families and businesses and would be identical to us if we were doing the same thing in another country.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's seen as courageous, you know, when we're talking about our ancestors or, you know, the struggles that we have gone through in this particular nation. That's seen as a good thing. We can't seem to extend that to others, and it's really sad. It's sad. It's a lost opportunity to identify with people that really are a boon to any community, and we should be welcoming them. So what else? There's so much. We don't have time. I'm looking at. I'm looking at this story here. I'm following the dictator of Brazil, Bolsonaro, you know, the right-wing monster that's currently in charge there.
Yeah, I think he was, what was it, accusing the left of starting Nazis?
Yeah, here's the thing. He's in Israel right now. He's in Israel. And he basically just said that Nazis are left-wing. They weren't right-wing. They weren't fascist. No, because there was the word socialist in their name, that makes them left-wing. Now, can you imagine saying something so ignorant and practically Holocaust-denying in Israel and being welcomed by their insane leader, who basically was one of the first people to celebrate this guy getting put into power? It's, what world are we living in?
Yo, can the Israeli leadership imagine becoming the very thing they're decrying in those types of museums? I mean, they don't see it, but I don't think any kind of administration, like right-wing or otherwise, would see it in the moment. But it's astounding that they're not calling this out and saying, yo, don't even go there.
Well, I mean, let's not be misleading here. The Jewish community is certainly calling this out. Netanyahu, no. He can turn a blind eye to this because he doesn't really represent the Jewish people. He represents the nation that he wants to build that I don't think stands for what the Jewish people need at all, and is one of the most harmful things. But, you know, the Jewish community is strong and self-critical, and I think in the end, reason will win out. It's going to be a tough road, though, with people like this.
Yeah, I mean, becoming an authoritarian state like that under the guise or proclaiming to sort of represent and on behalf of the Jewish people is, I think, my point, is particularly ugly.
Yeah. Bolsonaro is not a friend of the Jewish people. Trump is no friend of the Jewish people. The Republican Party certainly is no friend of the Jewish people. They are looking at strategy. They are looking at keeping conflicts in that region going forever for military purposes. Just look at your history. It's not hard to realize what the true intent here is. And it's just sad to see so many people buying into this, but I guess it's the only way we learn.
Yeah, so smash Nazis.
yeah, absolutely. Moving to more local local events, because it doesn't get any better. Do you know, we have a Trumper now who is running for the mayor of Port Jefferson.
I heard about
this. It's a small community just to the east of us here at Stony Brook.
In fact, there's a Stony Brook bus now, right? That goes down to there. Huh?
There is, actually. There's a shuttle, mm-hmm. a free shuttle that brings Stony Brook students to Port Jefferson. And apparently, it's outraged the pro Trump people because they don't want more students. No matter what it is, they are outraged by it. So having students getting a ride to Port Jefferson so they can walk around and spend money and be a part of the community, that's a bad thing, because I think the argument is, who's paying for this? My tax dollars are paying Yeah, and their spending in your community is also benefiting you. It's not worth having the discussion. It just never goes anywhere.
But biker gangs are better.
There's nothing wrong with the. First of all, it's not a biker gang. It's a bunch of people who ride bikes or motorcycles.
They would rather like the biker set than college students. I mean, which is better or worse? I mean, maybe there's a younger tendency with the students.
If those bikers weren't there, the place would be crawling with yuppies, and we would never be able to flush them out.
But yeah, they probably keep it real, you know. But I mean, as far as drinking or any kind of debauchery, I would argue there's plenty of other communities that have equal and perhaps more.
They're not concerned about that
bad behavior. Well, what is the concern? You don't want college. You don't want ideas.
It's people that look different. It's people that aren't from your particular block. It's people that come from foreign countries. It's that. I mean, let's face it. That is what it is. That's what all the resentment is about.
Appearing.
Yeah. But you know what? We haven't even gotten into the story.
No, so please. Sorry.
We've talked about this guy in the past. Now, hi, this is going to open up a couple of things here because there are actually no less than three people that share the name Laval. And in fact, we have a stadium here on campus that's named Laval Stadium. Now, there has been a movement over the years to rename that stadium because the guy it was named after is a state senator. And this state senator actually was one of the few people who did not stand up against conversion therapy or did not vote against it. He says that he's personally opposed to it, but he didn't believe the Senate legislation that was coming forth on that can have negative ramifications on the existing professional misconduct system, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Basically, it's he said this bill in contravention to that process declares the conversion therapy practices unused to be misconduct, thus removing expert analysis. It was not viewed in a positive way by many, and there has been a movement to rename the stadium from Laval Stadium to something else. Although they haven't come up with a very good name. I would say Evil Stadium or something like that. That kind of sounds like Laval.
Isn't there a credit union sign on the side of it anyway?
Yeah, that's something. You know what? I'm not even sure. I don't want to get into all the
Island Stadium.
Corporate
cool.
names. Yeah, I don't want to give them any more advertising. But the point is, this is a name that is in the area, right-wing Republicans who represent us. But this goes beyond that because there's another Laval. This is John J. Laval. He's a cousin of the state senator who is Kenneth P. Laval. It's going to get really, really confusing. And there's another one, too. That was Kevin Laval, is a Brookhaven councilman. We're not going to talk about Kevin today. All right, because it's just going to get too complicated.
Sorry, and you know what? I just mixed up the two venues. The stadium is the outdoor one.
Yeah,
and
you're confusing me, Kyle.
The one with the credit union, that's the basketball. Okay, sorry, I'm not a sports guy, you know. Sorry, sports people. Go on. Yes.
Are you finished?
Okay, we're talking about Pete.
We're talking about people. We're talking about Trump people.
Yeah.
Not sports.
Okay.
All right, so yeah, there's a lot of Stony Brook students want to rename Laval Stadium because, you know, this right-wing a guy who doesn't take a stand against conversion therapy. Is that really where we want to be playing games? Okay, fine. But this guy is reasonable compared to John J. Laval. He is the former GOP party leader in Suffolk County, and he is a Trump surrogate. He was a Trump surrogate during the campaign. Now, he is running for mayor to unseat five-term incumbent Margot Garrant. Elections are being held on June 18th. Now, in an interview, he said he had been asked by village residents to run in previous elections, but he had dismissed the idea because of his role on the county Republican committee. But apparently he doesn't have that role anymore. A small group of people who knew what I was doing came back to me and said, "Would you do this? We need some fresh blood and a fresh approach." Garrant, the incumbent, is a real estate attorney. She ran unopposed 2 years ago. She last faced an opponent in 2015 when she defeated a challenger almost, actually more than 2-1. And she said she was surprised Laval was running, adding he had not previously shown an interest in village issues. He's never been involved on any level. He's never attended a village board meeting. National politics has no place in local politics. Laval has appeared on television as a surrogate or advocate for President Trump. He said he is putting his political career aside after 10 years leading the county GOP. Brookhaven GOP chair Jesse Garcia succeeded Laval in the county post. I spent 10 years in that job, and I enjoyed it immensely, Laval said. Now that I'm moving out of politics, I feel that I can work locally and work with other residents to help make the village of Port Jefferson the best that it can be. First of all, if you're becoming a mayor, how are you moving out of politics?
Yeah, that's a misnomer.
It's a pretty political office there. It's the mayor, so that is politics. Yeah, it's different politics.
Maybe for political creatures, it's like a weaning them away from, you know, the big leagues, and this is like going back to, you know, just playing with your beer buddies on the softball team or something. You know?
Sorry,
I brought sports into it.
Yeah, you keep doing that. I can't imagine the horror of having a Trumper running a local village. I just can't imagine that. The attitudes, you know, we'll be checking people's immigration status in the streets, or, you know.
Or coming off the ferry.
Coming off the Port Jefferson ferry, all kinds of horrors like that. And just attitude, ignorance. You know, we've seen the guy who has the property on the corner of Route 25A and Broadway, who keeps putting up his pro-Trump signs in violation of village rules, and just basically bullying people into accepting his way because he owns a lot of property.
Can we list off all the businesses?
Yeah, if you want to, if you know them.
Okay, Steam Room, the ice cream shop. I don't know what it's called.
The Frigate, I think.
It's like the dog ice cream. Where yeah. They have dog ice cream.
I mean, people have opinions. People have opinions in these places, and that's fine. But to simply make yours a huge banner that overrides everybody else, it's wrong.
He also knocked down the Jefferson Monument.
He did. Okay.
Put a damn bird there.
After 9/11, yeah, he actually tore down a statue of Thomas Jefferson. Regardless of what you think of Thomas Jefferson, at the time, he basically represented freedom. You know, the town is kind of named after him. Tore it down, replaced it with like a military eagle type thing because of 9/11, and has never been replaced, even though he said he was going to bring it back, never did. So, yeah, that's the kind of mentality that we're dealing with.
I got to tell you, there's enough of these people in the area, you know, the guys with the flags in their trucks and stuff. Nothing against flags, nothing against trucks, but, you know, this isn't exactly a liberal bastion out here in Suffolk or on Long Island in general. So if you're a college student or if you're a member of the community, this is the sort of chickens coming home to roost, or chickens taking a break from being surrogates and coming home and spewing their garbage in your backyard. Look, as leaders,
it's not, you know, it may not be a liberal bastion, but there is a liberal presence and there's a conservative presence too, and I you know, respect that, I acknowledge that. But when you try and bully people by basically silencing opposition, putting up huge, massive signs, driving your damn pickup trucks with loud mufflers and huge flags, and just kind of, you know, intimidating people, that's where I draw the line. And I draw the line if the liberals are doing something like that, too. And, you know, they have done bad things, and I do mention it when they do as well. This is a bad move. This is something that I think, you know, I would like to see a race. I would like to see an opponent, absolutely. It's not right to have somebody running unopposed. But to bring policies that of Trump to a local level like this would be detrimental. Think of environmental issues. You know, think of the kinds of things that would be allowed. The kind of dumping into the harbor, or God knows what, drilling for oil right off West Meadow Beach or something, or Port Jefferson or whatever.
Or how about opposing and thwarting things like wind power, solar, any kind of progressive environmental policy for energy, transportation, you name it.
Yeah.
You know, that will be like saving the Jeep people, you know, like create a protected species for people that drive Jeeps, who are, in my opinion, probably all bad people. But
wow. Okay, you're making a lot of generalizations here, but yeah, the thing is, we talk about acting locally. Well, this is how acting locally can be either good or bad. If acting locally repeats the mistakes of what's happening nationally, then we're simply going down the wrong road. If we start building up and doing better things, smarter things, more enlightened approaches to problems, then and I'm not saying the current administration in Port Jefferson has succeeded in doing that. I don't know. Maybe they have. Maybe they haven't. I do know that somebody who agrees with Trump, who represents Trump on all levels, is not what is needed locally in any community, let alone one as nice as that one, one as close to the Starnberg campus as that one. And having more integration between the university and this community, which is the closest thing to a college town, I think that we have. You know, it's good to have that relationship. And when people see that as a threat, that is the problem. When people view outsiders, quote unquote outsiders, or even label people as outsiders, that is the problem when that kind of mentality is prevalent.
And I think what we're saying is really, you know, in the face of this, we need to ask ourselves, what good would this really bring to the community there and the community at large in Suffolk County and in Brookhaven in general?
I was just, you know, flabbergasted when I read this. Like, oh no, it's not ending anywhere. It's like finding out that, you know, a Trump surrogate's moving next door and
I'm telling you
all kinds of new rules.
More lifted trucks, more Jeeps. It's just going to be nothing but Jeeps and bikers and trucks.
You see, you basically apply brands of vehicles to political mentalities, and I don't see how that happens. It's true, it does happen.
Yeah,
but I don't know how. I don't know why. Maybe we should drive Jeeps and ride, you know, motorcycles and things.
No, we shouldn't.
Why not?
But yeah, they're going to be rolling coal everywhere, and yeah, blowing diesel all over everyone. It's a mentality. It's a lifestyle.
Is it a mentality or is it a reaction to something that they are being told?
It's an allegiance.
And this is their way of fighting back.
Yeah, well, it's the same reason that, like, branding and, you know, certain things, accoutrement of maybe a liberal set.
Whoa.
like berets.
Wow. You and your $20 words there.
Do you think Republicans are really, like, you know, buying berets en masse? No, that's kind of a liberal thing, right? Like,
wait,
I don't know.
Buying berets en masse, that's a liberal thing?
Well, I'm joking.
I haven't. Okay.
You know, it is branding. It is associated with a particular lifestyle, a particular ideology, a particular allegiance. Okay. And maybe it involves the Pledge of Allegiance too. I don't know, but I'm exaggerating, but not. And I'm speaking through the language of just vehicles alone, without pitting specific individuals. But I do think that, you know, students have a place too, and these communities shouldn't just be about masculinity and sort of macho truck people or whatever.
Okay, but you know, I want to stop with the truck thing. I want to stop with the bike thing because I think that's overgeneralizing. Because, you know, we come in contact with many people like this, and I think they get it. I think they are as open as anybody. We went to the South. People were great there. People were friendly, and you know, they may have been Republicans. They may have been Trump supporters. But I think there's something beyond that that we need to reach as well. And when you can connect to people, when you can communicate with them and say, okay, you know, you recognize me as a person, I recognize you as a person, we can have a conversation based on that, that's progress.
Great.
I don't want to make the same mistakes.
Great, great. You know what? Prove me wrong. When the majority of the people I'm describing are aligned in the ways that we're talking about as an ideal or a political utopia or whatever, I'm happy to be wrong. I will be dead wrong that day. Please. Love to be. I want to be.
I don't think any group of people will align in the right way. I think, you know, if I'm hanging out with a crowd of liberals, I'm going to be very uncomfortable because I'm going to find something that they don't like about me, and I'm going to find something I don't like about them, and it's going to be an issue. And that is what I hate, when those things become issues. You know, we need to accept each other's differences. We need to listen to each other. And nobody is doing that. Nobody is doing that. What I'm saying here, though, is that when you have a mentality that basically, by definition, closes off dialogue, closes off certain types of people, and that is what we see with people who align themselves directly with Trump. I'm not categorizing the people who drive trucks and people who drive bikes as those people. But when somebody who is admittedly a surrogate for that particular person, that is going to bring in a mentality that that views any outsider, anyone who looks a little different, with suspicion. And that is, I think, what we need to focus on primarily. And the people, I have faith in the people for being able to be able to dialogue and to be able to communicate.
Right.
I'm just more worried about politically what is happening locally as well.
Yeah. And my point, I think, is just a metaphor for the kinds of codes and signals that we use, whether it's clothing, whether it's, you know, vehicles and lifestyle in general. And when it comes down to, you know, students getting off a bus who maybe don't look like the type of people that come to your bar or wherever, and, you know, who then is being protected? Whose interests are being looked out for? I'm arguing that it's people not getting off that bus. It's people stepping down from one or the other type of other vehicle. But that is a metaphor, okay?
I maintain that their interests are not being looked out after either, that they're actually being hurt by this as well. And I think when people
you're right. Yeah.
When people see how they benefit, I think that's when you actually have an epiphany.
That's the entry – that's the fissure for the conversation, where the people themselves can forget about any kind of political allegiance or alignments and actually say, okay – you know, maybe we need truck parking, and maybe we need students, you know, over, you know, helpful regular service from the college campus. But
the beauty of us, when we go to different places where people are very different from us, come from different political backgrounds, we see the beauty in them. We see the beauty in their lives, in their, you know, fixing their trucks, or if we're, you know, stick with that, or just, you know, other things that they do that we would never do. But just listening and seeing and sharing, I think that's when you actually open up and are able to share something and get beyond all this crap that we are constantly mired in. But hey, I don't want to get mired in because we're running out of time. And I want to read this amazing letter that we got. We just got this letter from somebody in Canada. And, you know, we got a few letters, and I want to thank people who wrote into us. I want to encourage more people to write into us, otw@2600.com. This is a letter from Kirby. He wrote to us from, okay, I'm going to get this wrong, Etobicoke, Ontario. Etobicoke. Etobicoke is a former borough on the western edge of Toronto. While no longer official, the names of the old municipalities are still used dearly by some. It's important to note the name Etobicoke is based on a First Nations word meaning the place where the alders grow. I don't even know what an alder is.
It's a tree.
Oh, okay. As with much of our country, they were the first to live on these lands. Now, Kirby works in a museum. I'm not going to say where he works exactly, but in a museum or exhibit hall, getting exhibits tested, ready, clean for visitors. And he spends the first few hours completely alone, roaming from hall to hall with a service cart and my music and podcast bellowing through the cavernous spaces. And he says, I want to thank you both, Emmanuel and Kyle, for keeping me company and providing such brave and important news, discussion, and analysis on your off-the-wall program. I also have to give a shout-out to Rob, Voltaire, Alex, the rest of your crew from Off the Hook, who also do such a great job. That's our Wednesday night show. Some ask how I can wake up every weekend at 5 a.m. I enjoy my work, but I also look forward to listening to my friends on the radio because that's what you guys have become. Do you think he's listening to us now in the cavernous halls of that museum at 5 in the morning somewhere?
Yeah, maybe our show from last week or whatever day
it'd be
working.
This week.
Yeah.
Hello!
Echo!
Wow. Hear that echoes all the way down the hallway.
Echo!
And the beauty is, there's probably other people also wheeling carts through cavernous hallways somewhere in the world that our voices are echoing through. Where do you listen to Off the Wall? We'd like to know. Where's the most unusual? Are you on a space station? Are you on an ocean liner? You know, are you a coal miner? We'd like to know. You can take us anywhere. You can.
Even your truck.
Even your truck, yes. You can go through the streets and bellow it through your speakers. Last week, you were upset with the lack of callers and feedback and wondered if there was anybody out there. Kyle seemed like he was going to hitch a ride to the coast and take up surfing, leaving the troubled world far behind for a beach hut. I got that distinct impression. I wanted to reassure you that your efforts are valuable, and yes, even if the phones don't ring, there is someone out here. We are out here. What you do matters. that makes a real difference in so many ways. We are out here empowered by knowing that we are not alone in our ideas and thoughts. We are out here encouraged by the defense of the true nature of hacking, the endless curiosity to discover how things work and share what we have learned. We are out here questioning everything and wondering how we can make this world a better place. We are out here made better by your sharing of ideas, opinions, and information. Thank you both again for your efforts. And if you ever plan to travel to Canada, let me know. Thanks, Kirby S. Thanks for the most amazing letter we've gotten in a while. And I got to say, hearing words like that makes a huge difference to us. It makes what we do feel a lot more worthwhile. It's easy to discourage yourself. It's easy to think, yeah, you know what? No one cares. And I think nobody is immune from that. And sometimes just acknowledgement. And this goes on all levels. Acknowledge people around you. Acknowledge people that have made a difference. Acknowledge people that you don't even think will ever acknowledge you back. It matters. It matters so much. But I want to acknowledge Kirby because it's a wonderful letter and really made me feel good. I know you've got a big smile on your face, Kyle.
Yeah. No, I would just add and acknowledge family, however you define that. But acknowledge family, acknowledge the people and animals and creatures around you and in your life, the things you have an impact on, because it can make a big difference. And I was upset. I wasn't going to run away necessarily, and I may yet do a bit of surfing just to get out a bit and not think about as much politics as we have been. It feels like the last century, but just for the last, I think, 2 or 3 years. And it was the most beautiful letter to read, and I really appreciate his very, very kind words and the imagery. In fact, the first time I read it, I thought he was listening on like earphones or something, but your reading of it made me realize it was he's blasting it, which is great. I'm sure other people do that too. I know when I was a listener, I would play it all over my home and in every way I could, sometimes working on cars, restoring vehicles and doing stuff in a garage. I would listen to the show and wait, maybe listen to Democracy Now and then catch you speaking or catch the guys from Off the Hook while I was, taking apart a motor or doing whatever it is I was doing. And it was great to have in the background and feel a part of the conversation and of this great family here on the airwaves, and whether it's community radio or Pacifica or in just the world of thinking people in the United States and elsewhere around the world. So please share and write in, and it's just refreshing to get a letter just because and some perspective, and that visual is really, really important to hear because, we want criticism and stuff like that. We want to hear counterpoise and other sides of the argument that we're making, but it's great to have people share with us the impact and what it means to hear our shows.
And you can write to us, otw@2600.com, add your voice, and we'd like to share your experiences. And actually, we will be in Ontario in the weeks ahead, I believe, but not that particular part. If we are, we will certainly shoot you an email and maybe see these cavernous hallways for ourselves. Hey, before we go, I wanted to quickly go over a project that Kyle and I are involved in. We've talked about this before, where we are seeing year by year how film has developed. We started in the 1800s, and now we're deep into Academy Award winners. We started with the first Academy Award winner, 1927's Wings, a silent movie all about World War One. We've talked about that. We talked about the second one, the Broadway Melody, which was really a terrible film, but it was the best film of the time, apparently, according to the Academy Awards. That came out in 1928, 1929. 1930 was All Quiet on the Western Front. We moved on to a film called Cimarron. You remember that? A Western film.
Yes.
1931. Grand Hotel after that, 1932.
Nothing ever happens.
Nothing ever. I love that. That was what they kept saying. Has Lionel Barrymore. We keep running into him and various other films.
Absolutely.
Cavalcade came after that.
Cavalcade.
1933, a Frank Lloyd film. It's one of these epic films that goes from the end of the 19th century up to the current day, which was 1933. You see the sinking of the Titanic.
Wasn't there like Giza and like Egyptian stuff with huge amounts of extras and so on?
And Cavalcade? I don't know about
maybe
that.
Not.
That was more a British type of a thing.
Okay.
Upper class couple in England.
Okay.
It happened one night. American romantic comedy, produced by directed and co-produced by Frank Capra. It was basically all about a Clark Gable bus ride from I think Florida up to the Northeast, and she was trying to escape her domineering father, and he was a newspaperman. Remember that?
Vaguely.
Okay.
We've seen
a lot of films,
them.
So they don't always stick in your mind. Mutiny on the Bounty. Mutiny on the Bounty, 1935.
Classic pirate.
Another Frank Lloyd film, and
Privateer. Yeah.
And so many references that we see to this day, based on a film like that. Then 1936, The Great Ziegfeld. It's a musical drama film directed by Robert Leonard. About the theatrical impresario, Florenz Ziegfeld. Interesting biographical film. I do recommend that. And that was followed in 1937 by The Life of Emile Zola, which is interesting because they're both Z's, they're both biographical. It's about a 19th century French author. It basically told a very interesting story about... about all kinds of social stands. It was set in the mid through late 19th century. Depicts Zola's early friendship with post-impressionist painter Paul Cézanne, his rise to fame through his prolific writing, and dealing with anti-Semitism too, which is something that they just didn't deal with very much. You Can't Take It With You, 1938, another American romantic comedy film directed by Frank Capra. And let's see, Gone with the Wind. I don't really remember that one at all. That was 1939. Long film, 4 hours long, in color. That was something else. 1940, Rebecca, Alfred Hitchcock, the only Alfred Hitchcock film to win Best Film. So that's a little disappointing, but it was a really good film. I think he's done better. Unfortunately, we won't be seeing those in this particular series.
We could do a whole Hitchcock series.
How Green Was My Valley, 1941, which took place, or allegedly took place, in Wales, even though they seem to think it was Ireland, the way they had accents and words
great.
And things like that. That was a really good film.
That was all about the coal industry.
Coal mining and corruption of businesses. Things were a lot more progressive than you would give credit for in that time, in the 30s and the 40s. A lot of messages got out there. Mrs. Miniver, 1942, American romantic war drama film, because keep in mind World War II was starting to become very popular then. And there was
the Miniver Rose.
Yeah, it was all about entering a rose into a competition and people fighting and dying in war. And we just watched Casablanca from 1943. And that really is all about the war and just so many classic lines. Throughout the film.
He's just looking at you, kid.
Yeah, you heard that everywhere. And what we've been doing, and we're going to continue watching year by year and seeing the film that won the award. Might not be the best film, but it's the film that won the award, and we'll learn a lot from that. We also see newsreels and cartoons from that particular year, so we're learning a lot about how the war unfolded, how certain social things unfolded.
Propaganda.
And I'm always looking into the history and seeing how things developed, kind of like in a month-to-month basis.
Mm-hmm.
I learned about something known as the Battle of Brisbane. Did you ever hear about this? I bet nobody has heard about
this. Vaguely familiar.
I don't think you ever heard of it, because I never did.
Sounds Australian.
Well, okay, fine. Brisbane is in Australia, and they had a battle. Okay,
I'm sorry.
But the battle was a riot between United States military personnel and Australian servicemen. We're on the same damn side of the war, but we had a riot. And by the time the violence had been quelled, one Australian soldier was dead. Hundreds of Australians and U.S. servicemen had been injured. And news reports were suppressed overseas because, well, it made us look like idiots. But basically, to make this really quick, race was not a direct factor, but it was cited as a cause of tension between Australians and Americans and a contributing factor. This tension arose from the treatment and segregation of African-American soldiers by the U.S. military. Troops of the U.S. 208th Coast Artillery rioted for 10 nights in March 1942, fighting against African-Americans from the 394th Quartermaster Battalion. This was attributed to white American resentment towards African-American access to dance halls and for associating with white girls on the streets of Brisbane. As a result, U.S. military authorities segregated African-Americans, restricting them to the south side of the Brisbane River. But trouble continued with a major race riot at Wakal, knife fights in South Brisbane, American military police assaulting or killing black troops simply for crossing the Brisbane River. And this incited the Australians, whose culture towards military police was notably different. These are the kinds of little history lessons you learn when you undertake something like this. So I suggest for people interested in this, go through. You can find a lot of these videos on YouTube, newsreels and cartoons and things year by year. And you can do the research and find these award-winning films for next to nothing. It's so educational.
Watch them with your family. And also, if you have anybody from the older generations, someone who may have seen it when they were a lot younger, they can tell you so much to give you context. Maybe they fought in some of the wars.
Yes.
It's really great to see older folks light up when they recall what it was like when they first saw this film and so on.
Talk to them. Ask them questions.
Watch it with them.
We want to go out with a classic song from Casablanca because, why not, you know?
You must remember this.
No, not that one.
Please,
for God's sake.
Play it again.
Who the hell? No, not that one.
Play it.
One night in a thousand, we play Knock on Wood. Tonight's the night. Good night.
Say, who's got trouble?
We got trouble.
How much trouble?
Too much trouble.
Well, now, don't you frown. Just knuckle down and knock on wood. Who's unhappy?
We're unhappy.
How unhappy?
Too unhappy.
Uh-oh, that won't do. When you are blue, just knock on wood. Who's unlucky?
We're unlucky.
How unlucky?
Too unlucky.
But your luck will change if you arrange to knock on wood. Who's got nothing?
We got nothing.
How much nothing?
Too much nothing.
Say, nothing's not an awful lot, but knock on wood. Now, who's happy?
We're happy.
Just how happy?
Very happy.
That's the way we're gonna stay, so knock on wood. Now, who's lucky?
We're all lucky.
Just how lucky?
Very lucky.
Well, smile up then, and once again, let's knock.